Good afternoon. I call Human Services Finance Committee to order. Members, please take your seats. We have a quorum present. I would like to ask Chair Fisher, did you want to approve the minutes for March 5th, 2024?
Thank you, Chair Noor. I move approval of the March 5th, 2024 minutes.
Chair Fisher moves the approval for March 5th, 2024. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none. The minutes for March 5th, 2024 are now approved. Members, we do have a great discussion that we're planning for this afternoon. This is in regards to 1115 waivers. Don't want to take much of your time. I wanted to welcome the National Conference of State Legislators team to help us and guide us and inform us about the NCSL. We have Ms. Constanza on the Zoom, so I just wanted to welcome her. She is the health program lead at NCSL. Please welcome to the committee and introduce yourself, proceed your testimony. Or members, I think you can directly ask your questions through the mic. She will be able to pick up from there. So thank you so much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Chair Noor, and members of the committee for inviting us to present today. So my name is Catherine Costanza. I'm a program principal here at the National Conference of State Legislatures, and I'm here today to present on Medicaid Section 1115 waivers on social drivers of health and for reentry services. So if you're unaware, NCSL is your professional membership organization. We serve the 7,386 legislators and over 33,000 legislative staff in all 50 states, D.C., and the territories, with all of the services listed on this slide, including a trusted and nonpartisan policy research and analysis through presentations like this one and through individualized research requests. So if there are any questions that we're unable to answer after this or on other topics, please feel free to reach out to us anytime, and that's our role. We're more than happy to help. So today we're going to be covering Medicaid Section 1115 waivers, and I'll start by giving the fastest introduction to the Medicaid program and to Section 1115 waivers before we dig into the details about specific social drivers of health waivers and reentry waivers, and then finally touching on some of the resources that we offer. One thing I want to note is that there are more links and resources in these slides than we can cover in the 15 to 20 minutes that we have today, but these slides are really intended to be a resource for you. And as I mentioned, we're happy to provide any additional follow-up to any questions that you may have if we're not able to cover them today. And with that, we'll go ahead and dive straight in. All right, so I just want to briefly orient us in time and space to the Medicaid program and what it is that we're talking about when we're talking about Section 1115 waivers. So the Medicaid program, as you may know, is the public coverage source of health coverage to people with low incomes. And the important component of that is that it is jointly funded and regulated by both the federal and state governments. And there is shared responsibility for, because of that shared responsibility for funding, there are lots of federal requirements that are attached to federal funding. But despite these federal requirements, states have a lot of opportunities to exercise flexibility in the design of their program. And they can do this through state plans, which is the agreement between the state Medicaid agency and the federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which negotiates essentially the terms of the state Medicaid program. States can also do this through waivers, which we're going to discuss in a little more detail. And states can also exercise flexibility through state-funded programs. And all of these opportunities for flexibility essentially lead to this truism in the Medicaid program that when you've seen one Medicaid program, you have seen one Medicaid program. So keep that in mind as we continue. And we're not going to linger on this slide, but I do want to just walk through how the Medicaid ecosystem works, specifically how funding and innovations are implemented in the Medicaid program. So at the top of this slide, we have our federal actors. We have Congress, and we have the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. In the center, we have our state actors, including yourselves as the state legislature and your Medicaid agency, which between the two of you, you fund, regulate, and implement and administer the Medicaid program. And at the bottom, we have our constituents. So these are your Medicaid beneficiaries that receive services, your providers that provide services, and your vendors that contract with the state, including your managed care organizations. So when it comes to funding, you'll see that funding flows from both Congress and state legislatures into their respective agencies and flows into that single state Medicaid agency, which then pays out providers and vendors through the program. This is that joint funding mechanism. And next, the arrows in red and black represent the regulation and oversight of the Medicaid program, which we won't linger on, but as you can see, comes through all different branches of government and applies to all stakeholders in the program. And importantly, we have in the yellow arrow are innovations. And this is where waivers really come in. So as state legislatures, you can direct your state agency to exercise flexibility in the program. And your state Medicaid agency will go back and negotiate and work with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to both implement that flexibility and continue to receive federal funding. So that usually comes through approval and negotiation with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, including through Section 1115 waivers. And then finally, at the very bottom, we have the purpose for which this whole system is set up, which is for services to be provided to Medicaid beneficiaries. So what exactly are Section 1115 waivers? Well, Section 1115 waivers actually predate the enactment of the Medicaid program, but they essentially give states the authority to waive those federal requirements that are otherwise mandatory and continue to receive federal funding for those services. They can be broad or narrow in scope, so they can encompass entire state Medicaid programs like in Arizona and California, or they can be narrowly tailored to a specific purpose to test a very specific initiative in the state. Section 1115 waivers are subject to CMS's approval, and therefore they're going to reflect White House administration priorities and will change from administration to administration. They're also required to be budget neutral to the federal government, which can impose limitations on these services, and they're subject to ongoing monitoring and evaluation. And since these have been used more frequently in the Medicaid program since the mid-1990s to really test eligibility, benefits, and delivery systems. And these are highly individualized and specific to the state. And because they are subject to administration priorities and the approval discretion of CMS, they often involve lengthy negotiation processes that can take years with CMS. And with that, we'll dive in straight to social drivers of health waivers and more information about these. Sometimes these are also referred to as waivers for health-related social needs as well. So health-related social needs are defined as an individual's unmet adverse social conditions that contribute to poor health. And these can include food insecurity, housing instability, unemployment, or lack of reliable transportation, and can drive disparities across demographic groups. And what we know from research is that these health-related social needs can account for 40 to 50% of health outcomes, depending on how that's calculated. And we've included some links in here to how that's calculated. One important thing to keep in mind is that states already have several options to address health-related social needs through existing Medicaid authorities other than Section 1115 waivers. And these include that state plan, as well as home and community-based services waivers for certain individuals who qualify, typically older adults or individuals with disabilities. And states can also leverage certain managed care flexibilities, like in lieu of services or value-added services. So states may already be using existing authorities to provide housing and nutrition supports, supported employment, or non-emergency medical transportation, for example. So what are the opportunities of these waivers? Well, the real opportunity of these waivers is that it gives states flexibility to define the target population and eligible individuals and the covered benefits. So states can choose both broader or narrower eligibility than would typically be available under non-waiver Medicaid authorities. And states can also use federal funding for health-related social needs infrastructure, which can include electronic referral systems, trauma-informed training, community health worker certification, and community stakeholder gathering, as well as investments in IT systems. And additionally, there are specific services that are covered under these Section 1115 waivers that are not typically available under traditional Medicaid program authorities, including up to 6 months rent on the housing side and home delivered meals up to 3 times a day. Traditionally, Medicaid will not and federal funding will not cover spending on room and board. And this is an exception to that. However, there are also quite a few limitations associated with these waivers, because the intent of these waivers for social drivers is to supplement and not replace social services spending. So CMS has put in quite a few guardrails around these waivers, one of which is that the state must demonstrate and maintain partnerships with state and local government programs and social services providers for non-Medicaid funded services. The state can only expend, state expenditures on health-related social needs cannot exceed 3% of the state's annual total Medicaid spend, and infrastructure costs can only account for 15% of those. The state must maintain or increase social services spending for the duration of the waiver. And states must ensure that primary care, behavioral health, and OBGYN rates are at least 80% of Medicare rates. And states must establish both clinical and social risk criteria for populations that receive these health-related social needs services. So that includes, for instance, a particular diagnosis of a chronic condition or HIV or substance use disorder, as well as a social risk criteria like risk of homelessness. And with that, we'll take a look at what states are doing here. So at least 19 states have received CMS approval for waivers that include housing and nutrition supports. And 17 states have pending approval, but they are not listed on this map. So on this map, the states in blue have sought waivers to cover housing supports, but not nutrition supports. The one state in red, which is Delaware, hiding in the corner over there, covers nutrition supports, but not housing supports. And the states in green, including Oregon and Arkansas, New York and North Carolina, cover both housing and nutrition supports in their in these waivers. And I also want to flag that there are other health-related social needs services that are not captured here, such as employment supports, supports for transportation, and interpersonal violence. But these are not captured within the scope of this particular map, and these are approved on an individualized basis. So briefly, we'll discuss a couple quick state examples of what these waivers look like. So New York and Washington State are covering all nutrition supports that are available, including counseling and education, home-delivered meals up to 3 times a day, nutrition prescriptions, and grocery provisions of up to 6 months, while Arkansas is only covering nutrition counseling and education. On the housing support side, Arizona and Oregon are covering most housing supports, including housing navigation services, pre-tenancy and tenancy sustaining services, one-time transition and moving costs, home modification and remediation, and that rent up to 6 months, which is that unique service under these waivers. On the other hand, Montana's waiver covers pre-tenancy and tenancy sustaining services and one-time moving costs, and that's offered less than statewide. And one important note is that while the exact features of the targeted populations vary across all states, we are consistent states are targeting services towards individuals at risk of homelessness, are involved in the criminal justice system or recently released from incarceration, and who have behavioral health and substance use disorder challenges. So we'll see that this overlaps with a lot of state reentry initiatives, and we've seen many Section 1115 waivers that include both reentry and social drivers. All right. And so one thing I would be remiss if I didn't mention, we're not going to linger on this slide, is that there are alternatives to addressing health-related social needs outside of waivers. And that includes for states to use existing authorities, to leverage case management and community health workers, and to engage in data collection. So screening for health-related social needs and analyzing those needs for particular populations within the Medicaid program. And I've provided state examples here, but we're not going to linger there in the interest of time. And with that, let's move on to reentry waivers. So reentry waivers are born out of an exclusion in the Medicaid program called the Medicaid Inmate Exclusion Policy. So from the inception of the Medicaid program, the Medicaid program has prohibited federal funding for services provided to inmates of public institutions, except in certain limited circumstances when those individuals are admitted to a hospital or other facility for inpatient care. However, in recent years, research has found that the mortality and morbidity rates of individuals released from incarceration is significantly higher than the general population. For example, a study in Washington found that former state prisoners were more than 10 times more likely to die from overdose than the general population, with the highest risk of overdose in the first week post-release. And so in light of some of these findings, Congress in 2018 passed the Support Act and directed CMS to provide guidance on how states could waive the Medicaid inmate exclusion policy. Now, CMS issued its guidance in April 2023, so there was a little bit of a lag time between when states knew that they could submit, for instance, waivers, and when CMS issued its guidance. So about 14 or 15 states submitted Section 1115 waivers before they had guidance from CMS on what could be covered. So what are the opportunities for these waivers? Well, these waivers give states the opportunity to waive that Medicaid inmate exclusion policy for a limited duration of time and receive federal funding for services provided in that pre-release period while individuals are still an inmate of a public institution, as well as funding for IT systems and capacity building for training, workforce development, and to support connection between correctional settings and the Medicaid program. And states have flexibility in the scope of these waivers. They can narrowly target the population to certain individuals or to all Medicaid-eligible beneficiaries that are currently incarcerated. They can determine the scope of covered services to include all services covered under the state plan or just the minimum required services. And they can focus on covered correctional facilities, whether that's local jails or prisons, the providers that furnish services in that setting, and the geographic scope. So they can make it available statewide or limit it to just a regional or county-based program. And the limitations are that there are three minimum services that states are required to provide, which is case management, medication-assisted treatment, and a 30-day supply of medications. And they can provide those services up to 90 days pre-release, but not before that. So how many states are uptaking this? Well, as of February this year, or a couple days ago, 20 states have sought Section 1115 reentry waivers. And on this map, the states in red have pending Section 1115 waivers that have not been approved, whereas the three states in green, California, Montana, and Washington, have received CMS approval for these waivers. And I want to point out that this is a very hot and currently evolving area of policy. Within the last month, both Arkansas and Pennsylvania submitted waiver requests, and Montana received approval. So this is an area where we're currently seeing evolution in policy and changes in state uptake. So a couple examples that I'll provide of the scope of benefits, we're going to limit this to just approved waivers, because since there's such a wide spectrum of services and states may have submitted waivers before CMS issued guidance, the approved waivers may be a better indication of CMS's approval and likelihood of approval. So California's waiver covers all incarcerated youth and adults that meet certain clinical criteria. And that clinical criteria includes behavioral health and substance use disorder, pregnancy or postpartum, intellectual or developmental disabilities, HIV or AIDS, or other conditions. California's waiver goes up to 90 days pre-release and includes a limited benefit package that includes clinical consultation services for behavioral and physical health, laboratory and radiology services, community health worker services, and a 30-day supply of medical equipment in addition to the minimum services that are required. California's waiver is also interesting in that it includes funding for administrative activities, including those eligibility and enrollment processes, workforce training and hiring, and the IT systems infrastructure. Montana's waiver covers beneficiaries aged 19 and older, so adults only, who are inmates of state prisons, so not all correctional facilities, but just prisons, up to 30 days pre-release, and includes a limited benefit package that includes clinical consultation, the minimum required services for these waivers, and case management to address physical, behavioral, and health-related social needs. So again, we're seeing interaction between those reentry waivers and some consideration of health-related social needs. And finally, Washington's waiver covers incarcerated adults and youth in all settings, 90 days pre-release, with a limited benefit package that includes behavioral and physical health assessments, laboratory and radiology services, community health worker services, and medical equipment and supplies in hand upon release. And similarly, there's additionally actions that states can take outside of waivers here, which range from the focusing on improving the suspension and reactivation of benefits as individuals are released from incarceration, in-reach services, which are administrative connections pre-release to ensure a warm handoff, even though no services are provided, and data systems connection, so connecting Medicaid and corrections data systems to ensure that warm handoff and continuity of care post-release. And again, we're not going to linger on the state examples here, but they're here and there are links for perusing further. And finally, I do also want to point out that the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2023 implemented a new state requirement to provide a limited set of benefits Two, children and youth in foster care who are inmates of a public institution up to 30 days pre-release. And this will go into effect January 1st, 2026. So we don't have state examples yet. And this new law also gives states the option to waive the Medicaid inmate exclusion policy without time limits for children and youth in foster care who are awaiting disposition of charges in jails. So we're still awaiting CMS guidance on this, but this is an important component to factor in when you're thinking of initiatives in your state that may address pre-release services. And with that, we'll just follow up with some resources with additional information on this topic. So NCSL has a report connecting recently released prisoners to healthcare that we published in January of last year, before CMS had issued its first waiver approval or its guidance. But there's still some interesting information on there on state actions. NCSL has a housing and homelessness legislative database, and there are some additional resources from the Kaiser Family Foundation, the Health and Reentry Project, and NASHP that relate to some of the Medicaid flexibilities and authorities to address both social drivers and reentry services. You can also connect with us at NCSL at any of the links here related to our trainings, newsletters, podcasts, etc. And you can also reach out to me and my colleague, Johnny Valdez, anytime with any questions on Medicaid. We cover our Medicaid portfolio here, and that's what we're here to do. So please feel free to reach out anytime.
Well, thank you so much, Ms. Constanza, and also Mr. Valdez, who's also online. Members, any discussion on this topic? We've got the experts with us today. And I wanted to make sure that we really get to the nitty-gritty parts of the conversation about the 1115 waiver. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it would be very appropriate if we found out the variations of the details between the different waivers that have been submitted and approved, so that if we are coming up with language, we make sure we're consistent and don't accidentally have a difference which would delay approval.
Thank you, Representative Kwan. I think we also have the department who can provide us a little bit of a guidance, if there's any, one from the DHS. And then I will ask Ms. Costanza to help us with that.
Would be more than thank you, Chair Noor and Representative. We'd be more than happy to follow up with additional information. Additionally, because CMS has issued guidance, there is a nice for both of these waivers at this point. We do have a good template from CMS of what they will approve and what they will consider. And there is a range of flexibility within that. So just looking at approved waivers is not necessarily an indicator of what will get quickly approved. It is. But you can look at those in addition to CMS guidance. I hope that helps.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Sharon Noor. John Connolly, Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare for the Healthcare Administration at the Department of Human Services.
Welcome. I think we introduced you last time when we had the pre-session hearing. So welcome to the committee, Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. So I appreciate the presentation from our colleagues at NCSL about 1115 waiver opportunities. We understand there are a number of different proposals that have been put forth. And, of course, we within DHS and within the administration are exploring a variety of different options, two of which were highlighted today related to housing and nutrition specifically. A couple of things, I think, as we engage with both you all in the legislature and also with advocates and others in the community about different health-related social needs, concepts around those, and different waiver or other vehicles that could support this work, I think an important thing for us to note is also that we have a variety, I think as our colleagues at NCSL noted, a variety of different either state plan benefits, recuperative care is a recent one that's been implemented, or passed, I should say, in addition to other waiver vehicles. So a 1959 for housing stabilization is a good example. A range of different 1915C waivers for home and community-based services for older adults and for people with disabilities that do a range of things that have been described today. So certainly any new initiatives that we would digest or think through would be, entertained kind of in the context of those things that we've already done. And certainly, I think, credit to the folks here and to the community that's worked with you in passing those things in previous years, really years or decades of work have been done to, I think, lead in the space of providing Medicaid-funded services to respond to health-related social needs.
Assistant Commissioner, do we usually suspend the Medicaid eligibility for anyone who is incarcerated or if they're also in pretrial?
Yes. So rather than disenroll them, their enrollment would be suspended.
And how does the re-enrollment take place when they are suspended and we enroll them once they're living, from jail?
Yes, so the re-enrollment process, thank you, Chair, the re-enrollment process would occur through the counties, and so they would go through a process of reactivating folks who had been enrolled in the Medicaid or medical assistance program upon incarceration. So upon reentry, that would happen.
And since we're not connecting with people before their release, so we end up missing the opportunity for individuals who may not be re-enrolled, is that possible?
Yes, so as you heard folks from NCSL describe, one of the advantages of pre-release services would be to initiate that enrollment or re-enrollment process or reactivation of Medicaid eligibility ahead of reentry or release into the community.
I think I have Lee Newbindley on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Deputy Commissioner. My question is, early on in the presentation, I didn't totally catch what you were talking about, but it was on that initial slide of four requirements, and you said that they can be broad or narrow, and I think you mentioned a couple of states that that waive entirely. You mentioned Arizona and one other state maybe. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Ms. Costanza.
Thank you, Chair Knorr and Representative. Yes, so some states have had decades-long Section 1115 waivers under which they operate their entire Medicaid program. Now, that doesn't mean that every single component of their Medicaid program waives every federal requirement that there possibly is. But it means that they have chosen essentially to implement more experimentation into their program. So another good example of this is Tennessee. Both Tennessee and Arizona, for several decades now, have had a longstanding Section 1115 waiver. And the reason for its initial implementation was to deliver statewide managed care before managed care became an option that was available outside of Section 1115 waivers. In California's case, Section 1115 waiver has evolved over time to include a lot of demonstration initiatives. So often what we see with those kind of broad statewide entire Medicaid program Section 1115 waivers is that there was a broader purpose of reforming an entire delivery system in its implementation. Oregon is maybe another example of this. Whereas with a lot of other state initiatives and with CMS guidance, for instance, these reentry waivers and social drivers waivers, these do not necessarily have to be those broad waivers. They can be very narrow waivers that are tailored to the scope of what CMS has indicated it will approve for the scope of these Section 1115 waivers. So reentry and social drivers waivers would be considered a narrow waiver, but many states that have broader waivers and these statewide waivers have included those as amendments to their existing broader delivery system kind of waivers.
Thank you. That was very helpful. I appreciate that. My other question is actually going off of what Representative Quam asked and suggested. That made sense. I think you said three states have received approvals there's three states who have been approved for these Section 115 reentry waivers. Have any states, are the rest of the states all in process? I assume that there isn't necessarily a denial, but a letter stating, well, this won't work, but this will. Do we have an idea of any particular items or initiatives that have been deemed not okay for a waiver?
Ms. Constanze.
Chair Noren, Representative, that's an excellent question. To my knowledge, none of the waivers have been denied or approved, partially approved with certain services not covered. However, I would need to take a deeper look at some of the approvals to see if, for instance, specifically for California, Washington, and Montana, if in the approval CMS said we're going to approve most of this but not all of it. I think that would probably be where we see maybe the most winnowing down. But to my knowledge, there's not any, there have not been any flat out denials, and there have not been any partial approvals for the scope of services that we've looked at. I think that, again, this may follow up to your point to Representative Quam's earlier question about the scope of what has been approved and whether there were any partial denials or partial approvals included in those. I'm not aware of any flat out denials though. And to my knowledge, they have been pretty pretty robust approvals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Any other member discussion? And we have Assistant Commissioner, I think if you wanted to ask more questions about the process and procedures, I know we have some challenges when it comes to how we proceed. I know you have had about 1915C, you have had about the 1115 waivers. This is a broad base. We also have the state plan. So we've heard from many advocates about these issues, and we'll start discussing some of the bills that we wanted to put forward. So with that, I just wanted to give the closing remarks to Ms. Constanze, and if maybe Mr. Valdez.
Yes. No additional closing remarks on our end. We are here as a resource, and we will follow up with those additional resources on the specific CMS guidance on both of these waivers, which I think will help follow up on some of the questions that we received today and can provide more information about the scope of approvals that have been provided. Thank you again so much, Chair Noor, and members of the committee for having us today.
Thank you so much. We appreciate you joining us and presenting the 1115 waiver so we can understand the bills before us today. So again, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
As we go ahead and change from Zoom to back to a normal process now. We have two bills. And the first bill that we have is House File 3642. And since these bills have been introduced in terms of what the intentions are, I wanted to begin with the 1115 waiver, so I'd like to move House File 3642 to be laid over for inclusion. So we have some few differences in how the bill was drafted and the conversation we continue to have, so we'll have some changes and amendments later on. I wanted to welcome our testifiers. Dr. Winkleman, welcome to the committee, if you're around. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony on this topic.
Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Tyler Winkleman, and I am the co-director of the Health, Homelessness, and Criminal Justice Lab at the Hennepin Healthcare Research Institute. I practiced in the Hennepin County Jail for 5 years, where I started the largest jail opioid treatment program in the state. I'm also a practicing primary care physician and the division director for general internal medicine at Hennepin Healthcare, which provides substance use and primary care services at the Hennepin County Jail, as well as other community-based clinics. Our lab's research shows that people incarcerated in jails and prisons have extraordinarily high rates of mental health, physical health, and substance use conditions. Over 75% of people in the state with an opioid use disorder will pass through our state's jails and prisons. After release from Minnesota correctional facilities, our research indicates that the risk of death from overdose is 15 times higher than in the general population. Using Medicaid to cover individuals during their transition back into the community will save lives and reduce the impact of the opioid epidemic on Minnesota families and communities. Our research also shows that the Affordable Care Act increased health insurance rates for people recently incarcerated once they're back in the community. However, the ACA did not improve access to mental health or behavioral health services for people leaving jail and prison. And this is in part because of the disruptions in care and health insurance people have during periods of incarceration. Providing Medicaid prior to release will improve linkages to needed care and ensure that individuals receive health services that can support successful reentry. As a clinician and researcher in this field for the past 9 years, I strongly urge you to pass this critically important bill. As our previous speakers mentioned, 20 states have already requested such approval, and we pride ourselves in Minnesota on creating the country's best healthcare system. Now is not the time to fall behind. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Chair Fisher, did you have a question to the testifier?
Not to the testifier, but to the bill when we get to it.
All right. I do have another testifier, Jordan Hansen. If you're around, please come to the testify table and introduce yourself and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members. My name is Jordan Hansen. I am the executive director of a group called the Recovery Policy Alliance. We represent the over 300,000 Minnesotans who are living in recovery, the 150,000 estimated Minnesotans who are actively working through substance use issues, and the 1 in 3 Minnesota families that are affected by these issues. I'm here to testify in support of this bill. Very rarely do we get a chance to have a policy solution that I think makes this much sense across all the different systems that affect the folks we serve. In a past life, I was clinical director at Hazel and Betty Ford, and I worked doing consulting with places that look nothing like Hazel and Betty Ford, including Appalachia located jails. The biggest proponent for these measures in Kentucky were their jailers. And just like in Kentucky, our Sheriff's Association and the sheriffs that we talk to, they need help. I was in the Crow Wing County Jail a couple weeks back. They are using pen and paper to use their medical records because of the cost of, you know, getting an EMR in the jail. They are essentially operating a behavioral health triage in Crow Wing County in the jail setting. They can't get enough COs. They can't get enough help. What this bill would do is to take some of the pressure off these different parts of our system. And as Dr. Winkleman said, it would give care to some of the most vulnerable community members that we're looking at. This bill allows for a more intentional use of funding. One of the things that we noticed in Crow Wing County was because of the lack of short-term resources, we are incurring long-term costs. And so as we look at sort of the fiscal note and the different approaches to this, I think we need to be mindful of the cost shifting and the long-term consequences of not acting in the short term when health conditions are needing to be addressed. So thank you for your time and for your consideration.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hansen, for your testimony. The next person I have as a testifier, Travis Grancy. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Noor and members of the committee. My name is Travis Granzi. Excuse me. My name is Travis Granzi, and I am a deputy administrator in Olmsted County, overseeing our Health, Housing, and Human Services Division. Prior to serving in that role, I was the Community Corrections Director. I'm here today to speak on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators and Olmsted County in support of the bill, this House File 3642. We certainly thank Chair Noor for bringing this forward and leading this discussion, because as the other testifiers has mentioned, this is a very important topic and something that we really believe that the state of Minnesota needs to lean into. And counties have long supported eliminating this Medicaid inmate exclusion policy for the reasons that many of which that you've already heard. And this is a top priority for the Association of Minnesota Counties and the National Association of Counties. Minnesota has an opportunity at this point through the Medicaid reentry section 1115 waiver to move forward and better serve the members of our community. This would improve the care and coordination of services prior to release. And we can enhance public safety and public health by doing so. So the waiver really would increase the likelihood that people in custody receive crucial substance use and mental health treatment. And it would hopefully help avoid the disruptions in care that these folks have when they're in the institutions. Doing this, I mean, as a part of reentry, does reduce the risk of recidivism, which I know is something that we all also are paying attention to. Additionally, I would note that the federal inmate exclusion policy does not allow for these benefits from individuals that are being housed prior to conviction, so on a pretrial basis. And counties would really advocate that we pursue going further than the proposed waiver to seek 1115 waiver for individuals on pretrial status as well. Similar to the benefits for those folks that are returning to the community, those on a pretrial status also have their health care, whether that's mental health or chemical health care, interrupted when they're in custody as a result of that pretrial. Local jails, as many of you know, are really experiencing an increase in the severity of the mental health illness that they're facing with the folks that are in their care and custody. They recognize the need, and as was mentioned in previous testimony here, sheriff's associations and others are acknowledging the need for additional mental health services in our institutions. So as the legislature explores the 1115 waivers, we also ask that counties are at that table. We want to be part of the discussions and helping define what it is that would be best for the citizens that we serve in the state of Minnesota. Coordination is important between human services, community corrections, and the jails. So we appreciate the dollars that were allocated last session to DHS to pursue the 1115 waiver. And that the preparation with those dollars needs to include counties. We've advocated for this issue federally and at the state level for years, and we stand ready to participate and contribute to the success. I thank you for your time today. And
thank you, Mr. Granzi, for your testimony. And maybe stay around just in case of any questions. Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you for the setup that we had going into this. This is a very complicated process when we're dealing with Medicaid. The question that I have initially is, as I'm reading this, how does this help? Could this help address the boarding issue, and how can it help address where the counties and jails are boarding people that should have been discharged, but they have nowhere to discharge them, so they're hanging on to them? How can that be used in that type of situation?
I think that's a great question. I don't know if the deputy administrator for Olmsted County will be able to really help. This was part of the conversation during the priority admission. It's part of their recommendation. The entire county, actually, the counties, that's their number one priority. So it's really important. It impacts people who are supposed to be transitioning out so that they can get mental health support, substance use disorder support, and whatnot. So I don't know if Mr. Grancy or someone from DHS who was part of the evaluation of the reentry waiver can also help us with that. Mr. Grancy.
Chair Neuer, representative, the comment maybe that I'd have in response to that is anything that we can do to ensure that we're providing adequate mental health and chemical health services while folks are in custody will be beneficial, whether that's their last stop in the continuum of care or not. And if they are waiting for a bed in another facility, not having a disruption when they're incarcerated will certainly be a benefit to them down the line.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. So as I'm understanding it then is that this is something that even though I'm seeing the 30 days on here, I'm seeing at least 30 days. So that could help cover the costs of whatever treatment would have to be provided. So in other words, if somebody ended up waiting for a year, that would help pay for the costs and everything that they would then experience during that year while we're waiting for the discharge from the county facility to whatever the next, say, a group home would open up for them type of thing. Would that be am I having a correct understanding on that?
Chair Fisher, that could be a little bit different because we're looking into up to 90 days of pre-release so that individual who needs care, the medication, the mental health support, substance use disorder, and everything that they need, they're taken care of before they're released from custody. So the other piece I think we're trying to also help is move people from jails
into
a different setting. So that will be covered by one of the other 13 priorities that we've had from the commission and also from the department. So it's a different scenario, but it's also related to someone who's also in custody with behavioral health.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm hoping that in parallel to the waiver process that we are looking at better implementation when and if the waiver comes. As was mentioned with the mental health and substance abuse, these are individuals, and there may be a variety of best approaches for those individuals. And I hope that there's a discussion amongst counties for cooperative efforts because the population of incarcerated individuals across the counties vary, and that if you have a cooperative multi-county setup of implementing this or supporting, then you would be able to have, cover all the jails but not have a 0.2 or 0.3. This month we only need you for this portion of the work. The other thing is options of, peer review peer counseling for, both of those areas. People have been through it and have changed their lives that give the opportunity. So while the waiver is being worked on, we should look at best practices across the nation of how we could implement, especially in the greater Minnesota where there's a broader area and maybe some density issues for actually providing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kwong. Lee Newbrinley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a really interesting conversation. I really appreciate this. And Representative Fisher, I think that was a really interesting comment to bring up this boarding issue. And I'm trying to figure out how could we shoehorn this in, right? Because we've heard testimony that there are folks who need really minimal treatment and they really are deemed competent. I can't figure out how this will affect that because they've already have to be scheduled for release under this and they'd have to already have a place to go. But it seems like there's got to be a connection there, which is interesting. I've got a couple of questions about the bill itself. One, and I'm a little bummed that I didn't think of these things while we still had Ms. Costanza, but I'm wondering, clearly there will be costs to this. Do we have a fiscal note on this yet? And similarly, with the waiver, would we get equivalent funding from the federal government still? And so obviously it would be offset. It would not be entirely on the state.
It's a great question. I don't know if Mr. Beck wanted to.
Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley, the first part of your question, there is an active fiscal note request on this one. There's just to anticipate there's not yet on the next one. But I believe, as Chair Noor indicated, there's going to be some changes to the bill. So we'll have to renew that. Mm-hmm. On the other part, I think this is a waiver for MA services. So is my understanding is we would get our regular federal share, which is approximately 50%. That should be the case.
I think the different program have got different reimbursement rates.
Is it?
And so that's why I wanted to check in with the department. What will be the rate covered under the reentry waiver?
Yeah.
Because it changes some of the other program. Welcome back, Assistant Commissioner. Please inform us if there's any difference.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Yes, Chair and members. So the Medicaid match would be what the customary match would be for the beneficiary. So there are different matching rates attached to different beneficiaries, but depending on their eligibility, we would receive federal matching funds just as we would for any other program member and medical assistance.
So will this be 90-10 if there's specific programs that we're doing?
Yes, reentry? Could be.
So there's a difference between the services that are going to be provided, if that is correct, Assistant Commissioner. Lee New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. And I think my next question is maybe for Mr. Granzi. I'm wondering, as I look at the covered services, on lines 3.1 to 3.3, it's medication-assisted treatment services for all types of substance use disorders as clinically appropriate, with accompanying individually determined appropriate counseling and behavioral therapies. And I just don't necessarily know, are our jails and prisons set up for this, or are they going to have to make some changes to be able to accommodate this?
Mr. Grant.
Chair Noor, Representative New Brindley.
I'm sorry. Great. Call me whatever you want.
I won't do that.
Oh.
No, I appreciate,
I'm intrigued.
I appreciate
how
now my nervousness has got me off guard here. But, thank you. The question, I believe, in essence, is everyone set up and ready for this? And I'd say that at this point in time, there are different programs, different institutions are ready for different things. And I'd say that no, and that they could be, though. I think that the opportunity here, as has been requested for so long, is because folks recognize the need for it and the work required to be ready would be welcomed by the institutions.
Lee Newburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. So it sounds like, and I appreciate that you said, I mean, clearly this is still a work in progress, but that might be something that we need to think about. I mean, presumably this clearly will have a cost at some point, but we'll probably want to consider that cost to the counties as well. In ensuring that they can comply with the requirements of the bill. My only other question, now I get that this might be a silly little question, but we all know how I love little words. And as I look at the requirement on line 1.19 and 1.20, now I don't know why anyone wouldn't choose to enroll in Medicaid if they are eligible. However, the language does say that the commissioner must ensure that all who are eligible are enrolled. And it seems like there should still be individual choice in that an individual should be able to choose whether or not they are going to enroll. That certainly if they are eligible, they should be given that opportunity. But an individual should still be able to choose. Like I said, I have no idea why someone wouldn't, but just something that caught my attention. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Lead New Brunley. I'm sure you have listened to Dr. Winkler when he was explaining that the high morbidity and mortality rate for individuals who are incarcerated, and most likely some of those individuals who may not be able to take advantage to be able to receive those services, may be encouraged. But there isn't compulsion in that whole process. So the commissioner will do all you know, all the things that are needed. Assistant Commissioner, I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that.
Sure. There's no compulsory enrollment in medical assistance. So certainly we would do what we could in partnership with our partners at DOC or with counties, if it's a jail at a county, to support enrollment. But people can ask to be disenrolled at any time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just look at the language on that, because the language does imply compulsion. And like I said, I can't imagine why anyone wouldn't. But individual choice. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. I have Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just to make sure that we're understanding both the bill that's in force right now and also the bill that we'll intend to review again. But it sounds like basically there are incarcerated individuals that are not receiving certain types of health care, mental health assistance, substance abuse, and that what we're aiming for is to make sure they're getting more of that health care. And then the other part of it is having the federal government also pay for more of this health care that we want to get for individuals. And I just want to make sure that verifying that I'm getting the kind of the underlying what the goal of this legislation is. We would be able to accomplish those. We're trying to find that avenue to accomplish both of those things.
Madam Chair, I think the question about the two waivers. One is the reentry waiver, which I think we've had from the counties. We've had from many folks who have come to us that this is really needed right now. We have with crisis. And we want to solve that crisis. So the reentry waiver is kind of their top priority that needs to be addressed. The other one is the health-related issues, which we'll be talking about it. It's going to take some time to set it up. So we are going to get ready so that when we get the waiver, we have set our plans, the systems are ready. With this one, I think there's also the opportunity for capacity building, IT services, everything else that is needed. And we don't want to push a lot of things at the same time to the department. So we want them to bite the apple and continue to be able to chew what they can chew. So this is a really important one that we can actually, we have the framework. Assistant Commissioner, I don't know if you can help us and guide us. I know the report that we're waiting for and also part of our deliberation in how we tackle this issue is to make sure that we're ready.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair Noor, Representative. So you ask a very good question. And the opportunity here is essentially what you stated. So there are health services, a range of health services provided in jails and prisons currently. The inclusion of them in a Medicaid benefit, a 90 days, 30 days pre-release kind of arrangement, is that they would be eligible for federal match, as we've discussed. So current dollars being spent on those services would then be federal, would be matchable through the federal Medicaid program. So that does extend the range of things that you could do with that money. So it is possible that new or different things could be added to the service array depending on what's, you know, what's sort of within the plan. And there are requirements within the framework that CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services at the federal level, with the framework they've laid out for reinvesting funds that have been generated through the federal Medicaid match. So that's a part of the planning process that's required.
Okay. Chair Pryor.
Thank you. Thank you for further clarification and improving my understanding.
Representative Zavani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Granzi. I think I heard you say, if I wrote my notes correctly, that you wish this bill included the pretrial status. Is that correct?
Mr. Granzi.
Chair Noor, Representative, yes, we do. The vast majority of folks in our local jails are there on a pretrial status, the vast majority. And the vast majority of those return to the community without facing additional incarceration after their case is resolved. For those reasons alone, we think the continuity of care while they're in custody or the ability to start care while in custody and then transition to the community is very important. So that is why we've asked for the pretrial as well.
I have a follow-up to that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. How long can one be in the pretrial status?
Mr. Grancy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that varies significantly. There are folks that are held in our local jails waiting for their trial for over a year, over 2 years in some cases. That's rare. Generally, it's shorter term than that, but that does happen. So it can be a lengthy period of time.
Representative Vanning.
Thank you.
Just wanted to follow up with the department. I think if someone has got a waiver program and they, in their pretrial, do they lose their waiver program? And how long does it take for them to really get back their waiver?
I guess I'd ask for, thank you, Chair, ask for clarification a bit in the circumstances. So if they're in a
someone has got a CADI waiver program and they're receiving services in the community and they end up in jail through the pretrial, maybe even for 2 days or 3 days, what is the process once the county is notified about an individual who is in custody? Do they completely cut off that individual, although it may be 1 or 2 days that they're in jail? For that matter, do they lose and then wait for reapplication process?
Thank you, Chair. So in a scenario of 1 to 2 days of incarceration, I would need to check on that. I can certainly get an answer for that from the team back at the department. But customarily with incarceration, obviously Medicaid eligibility or enrollment, rather, would be suspended. In a case of a very quick incarceration like that, circumstances may be slightly different. So I can take that back.
Lead Newbrand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm hoping I can just ask a follow-up on that. So if this language were implemented, then what would happen on the other side? So they would have this waiver while they, for 30 days prior, pre-release. What happens when they are released? Is there going to be another lag on the other side then as they do a redetermination again?
Assistant Commissioner.
So, Chair and Representative, I assume the question is about the reentry waiver. Yes. So in that case, part of the aims of this waiver framework would be to do the re-enrollment or the reactivation if somebody is still eligible, which is likely given that they were incarcerated. That they're activating that enrollment again before they're reentering the community. Great. And part of the waiver framework is also then to create connections to needed service in the community.
Lynn Newbrandley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other member discussion? Seeing none, I just wanted to say thank you, Assistant Commissioner, and also Mr. Grancy, for your testimony and for being here. So with that House file, I renew my motion. House file 3642 is laid over. We have the next bill, which is 3639. Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 3639 to be laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have before us now, members, House File 3639, and Chair Knorr has moved that House File 3639 be laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, not seeing any amendments, we can go straight to Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think we have had from the experts from NCSL and others about the social drivers of health waivers. This is going to be more inclusive. Right now it says food insecurity, but this will be added with the housing component, hopefully, through amendment. So this bill is in our jurisdiction, so we're trying to make sure that it's more encompassing. We've had from many advocates, so I just wanted to give the opportunity to testify on the bill.
All right, and it looks like we have Sarah Peterson, if you'd like to come on down to the testifier table. Welcome. Go ahead and get comfortable. Then if you could say your name and your affiliation, and then go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Bonner and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Peterson, and I'm the Director of Neighbor Services at Second Harvest Heartland. We're pleased to support HF 3639, which will begin the 1115 demonstration waiver process for health-related social needs. At Second Harvest Heartland, a member of the Feeding America Network of Food Banks, we believe in the relationship between food access and good health outcomes for our Minnesota neighbors. In addition to the nutritious food and fresh produce that we distribute in the community via the Emergency Food Distribution Network, we also connect food insecure neighbors to many programs that help ensure longer-term access to food. And one such program is FoodRx, our version of Food as Medicine. Since 2018, the FoodRx model of care has built meaningful connections between patients, healthcare partners, and food security solutions. FoodRx aims to improve self-care management for members with diet-related chronic diseases and increase their food security through the provision of medically tailored groceries delivered directly to their homes. We also offer SNAP assistance and referrals to address other health-related social needs. We currently partner with multiple insurance payers that offer FoodRx as a benefit to members that are on a medical assistance or Medicare plan, like Minnesota Senior Health Option. We've seen great success in enrolling their members into the program and high completion rates. They have reported on improved clinical outcomes and engagement with healthcare systems, with the healthcare system among FoodRx recipients. So we know this model works. Lastly, I'd like to share a participant quote that reflects a lot of the feedback we receive on how this program benefits health and budgets. The program has completely transformed my life for the better. I have now tried tofu, wheat noodles, and beets, which I would have never tried before. Mentally knowing that I have something to eat when I wake up in the morning has made a world of difference. Your support of the 1115 waiver will allow more Minnesotans to have that peace of mind that comes with stable access to nutritious food. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Peterson. And with that, we have Megan Peterlentz, if you'd want to come on down. Wonderful. Welcome, Ms. Peterlentz. Hopefully I'm saying that correctly. If you want to go ahead and state your name and affiliation for the record and go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Bonner and committee members. My name is Megan Peterlentz. I am the Community Affairs Manager at Children's Minnesota. I appreciate you having me here today to express our support for House File 3639, which would initiate the process of Minnesota applying for an 1115 Medicaid waiver to address health-related social needs. Children's Minnesota is the state's largest pediatric healthcare system. We serve a diverse patient population, and nearly 50% of our patients are enrolled in Medicaid. Our vision is to be every family's essential partner in raising healthier children, and that starts with recognizing that 80% of what impacts the health of a child happens outside of our hospital and clinic walls. Equitable access to social supports, including food and housing, is essential to ensuring the health and wellness of children and their families. We know that children experiencing housing instability or food insecurity are at higher risk for developmental and academic delays, as well as behavioral and mental health challenges. In my role at Children's Minnesota, I have the privilege of leading our community health needs assessment process. We conduct an assessment every 3 years in compliance with federal law. These assessments are one of the ways we engage the communities we serve and respond to what they want us as a healthcare provider to prioritize when it comes to their health and wellness. I am here testifying before you today because access to basic resources like food and housing continues to be elevated through this process. Another way we learn about families' health-related social needs are when they participate in a social needs screening in one of our clinics. Food insecurity and housing issues are regularly identified as top concerns. Families can meet with a community resource navigator through our Community Connect program to help address those concerns. If nutrition and housing supports were paid for by medical assistance, our capacity and the capacity of our community partners to support these families would increase in an incredibly impactful way. Our communities are telling us what they need to be healthy, and Children's Minnesota, along with hospitals and health systems across the state, are working to be responsive to those needs. This waiver gives us the opportunity to use current systems to invest in what we know supports families' health and overall well-being. Thank you, Representative Knorr, for your leadership on this bill. We look forward to working with you and other stakeholders this session as the bill continues to evolve.
Thank you, Ms. Peterlins, for your testimony. I do not have any other testifiers listed. However, I would like to check in with the public at this time and see if there is anyone else in the room that would like to testify on this bill. All right. Seeing none, we're going to go ahead and move to member discussion. And I have Lee New Brindley on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Representative Norrie, the one thing I'm thinking about is, do you have any, it may just be speculation at this point, but how this might interact with SNAP?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Lee New Brindley, I think this is a different model. So with talking about food as health in terms of providing people with specific food items, which is authorized under the Medicaid. So when you see someone who's got a mental health, behavioral health, and all that component combined together, just to take an example, somebody who was who just left the jail through the pre-release program, they need housing, they need case management, they need food. As part of the program, it's going to cover the food component of that. Maybe I need to phone a friend to get more clarification on some of those other issues. I don't know if we have an expert in that process.
It looks like we have someone ready to come down and assist. Okay. All right. Thank you. If you, once again, we could state your name for the record and go ahead, proceed.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Bonner. My name is Sophie Wallerstedt. I'm the Public Affairs Manager for Second Harvest Heartland. And Representative New Brindley, that's a really good question. So SNAP is a federal program that people qualify for through their income. It is paid entirely by the federal government. And I don't think there is like going to be a specific interaction between SNAP and this 1115 waiver. Instead, what they're looking at is specific populations that they could figure out interventions, like nutrition interventions, that would work for them. So, for example, I know Representative Knorr was talking about folks that are leaving the criminal justice system, but if you have, for example, like a pregnant person who is at risk of homelessness, like making sure that they have access to nutritional food or nutritious food or prepared meals. So it would be in addition to any SNAP benefits if that person qualifies for SNAP.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
This program is not meant to supplement what we're doing. This is intended to be more specific. So for that matter, I think if someone is eligible for a SNAP program and getting the SNAP benefits, it's going to be different. This is more medically tailored food program or meals for that individual.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lee New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I mean, I assume that obviously this will all be laid out in the waiver application. But I wonder, I do wonder if that creates a little fuzziness for folks who qualify for SNAP, because I think logically this would supplant some of that instead of supplement. So that's something we probably just need to make sure is crystal clear, and then there won't be any fuzziness around, because I do remember in Ms. Costanza's presentation that was an important piece of qualifying for these waivers, is that it must be in addition to, it can't supplant. But I'm trying to imagine a situation where this wouldn't supplant. Like it just seems like logically it would almost have to. Either that or there would be an overabundance, maybe. So just something to consider. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lee New Brindley, one of my criteria has always been federal fund first. So if the SNAP program is paid through the federal program, mm-hmm. that will be the first benefit to look into before the other nutrition programs that are going to be included in that circumstances. So if someone is already eligible, they may need the housing support, they may need the case management, they may need to look into other social services that are needed to make sure that we can stabilize the life of that individual so they can thrive. So this is more of a 6 month transition. While SNAP program may be ongoing, it's an income based and so many other things. So the target here is to make sure that individual can be stabilized and transition to other things within that 6 months.
All right. Lee New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that clarification, Chair Knorr. And perhaps that really is addressed on lines 1.1 and 1.12, that whose nutritional needs are not being met by other food support programs. But so perhaps that will solve that problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Lee New Brindley. And Representative Fisher, you have a question.
Sure. Thank you. I'll keep it real quick. So the way I'm understanding the food component there is I could think of somebody who is about to be discharged from a hospital that was in, say, for diabetes, where they had a severe reaction or stroke, and they have to cut back on sodium or sugars and those kind of things. A lot of times the meals you have to go to are usually a bit more expensive, and also learning how to cook differently and how to get meals in that kind of situation, because I know so often people are used to getting the prepaid stuff, you know, the pre-prepared stuff, which is high in sodium, high in sugars. So this is getting to that component of making sure that they're being able to get the right products that may cost more expensive than just going to the prepared stuff out there.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, Chair Fisher, I think that's exactly why we needed this program. This is medically tailored meals to those individuals who need it. So may not be for everybody. I know we have got the other programs for folks who have specific foods that are also funded through SNAP program. So this will be a little bit more of a difference from those who are receiving additional programs.
All right, thank you, Representative Fisher. Okay, and I do not see any other members on the list. Is there anyone else with questions for Chair Knorr? All right, well then, seeing none, then we will renew the motion for Chair Knorr to move House File 3639 to be laid over. All right, the bill is now laid over. All right. Thank you, members. And with that, we have nothing else on the agenda for today. So we will go ahead and adjourn. Thank you for your time.